by this time, because of your love of flying, you must be buying an airplane. I mean, now you need to be flying around for business reasons. Is that true?
There is some of that, and I still fly. I'm still current. I still go to flight safety twice a year. I fly 275 hours, probably average, the last couple of years. And I do fly a jet, my own plane. The company has a plane that we use to shuttle employees back and forth between Midland and Tulsa 2 or 3 days a week. It's interesting because the FAA and the airlines used to make you retire at 60, couldn't fly past 60. So I told my wife 30 years ago that when they got to be 60, I would quit flying left seat in the front. They moved the retirement age to 65. So I immediately told her that I was going to fly till I was 65. As we said, I'm 67 now, still flying, but that's going to come to an end at some point. I do not want to fly. I know people who are in their 70s and maybe even early 80s who still fly and fly well. But at some point soon, I'm going to quit flying jets and high-performance aircraft and just stick to flying single-engine things for fun.
One of our other interviewees for Voices of Oklahoma was King Kirshner, who I think is 91 now, but probably gave up flying just a few years ago. You may know that better than I did, but he flew into his 80s, didn't he?
He did. King is just a remarkable person in many, many ways. And he's the exception, I think, to the rule that at some point you need to quit flying. Of course, he's flown hundreds of different type of aircraft. His hangar is right across the taxiway from mine, and I can't say enough good things about King.
Yeah, but at 91, he's still doing business.
Yeah, he's still involved.
Which is what you could be doing, too.
There's worse things in life than emulating King Kirshner.
I think it was in 2009 you drilled your first horizontal well in the Midland Basin.
That sounds about right.
And then you've drilled, I don't know how many, 300 more horizontal wells?
Yeah, probably 350 now.
350. And how many employees do you have?
We have around 350 employees or so today. It's a volatile business. We think we've got good employees. When prices cratered in 2016, we had a pretty big reduction in force, which is very, very painful. The entire industry did. So it's a business in which you kind of have to constantly look at every cost. And
yeah.
Employees are how you make money, and to do it right, you got to have them. Unfortunately for most people in the industry, when things get tough, employees are a cost also. So
yeah.
We really think we got good employees.
Have you had employees that stayed with you from previous companies?
That's part of what I've enjoyed is that we didn't pull very many over from Colt to Lariat. But from Lariat to Latigo to Laredo, we pulled over quite a few. In fact, I think out of the first 50 people at Laredo, 37, something like that, had worked for me before. The problem is we're all getting old. And some of my employees that have been with me 20 years, they've monetized some. And, you know, it's a hard business. And they're retiring, leaving, doing other things.
I'm thinking about a roughneck right now. How old can you be as a roughneck?
The question is, how old do you want to be and still out there in the heat and the cold and doing that in the rain and everything else?
Do you have some who are 60, 70?
We have some that are in their 60s. I don't remember any in their 70s, but I'm sure we do. Now, those are the guys that have the experience. So what you want them doing is helping younger guys do it. But if you live in rural West Texas and your parents were roughnecks, and you've stayed in rural Texas because you want to be part of that community, you want to be part of that lifestyle, you're probably running some cows someplace and farming on the side, but being in the oil and gas business in the field is kind of where your heart is if you're second or third generation.
So is it easy to be attracting the young people to the petroleum business?
On certain levels, it is, and I'll talk about that in a second, but if you're in the Permian today, there was an article today in the Wall Street Journal about a barber, cuts hair, who put together a mobile trailer with five chairs and barbers in that. He hauls it from field area to field area, literally, and cuts hair for field people who do not have time to go to a barber shop. And he makes a phenomenal living.
It's a great idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, actually a pretty good idea. We've seen food trucks. Well, this is a haircutting truck. On the one hand, hiring people across the industry today is extremely competitive. if you want to work in West Texas, you can find a job. If you've got a commercial driver's license and a good safety record, and you pass the drug test, you can make $120,000, that kind of number a year driving a truck. It's hard work. You're outdoors a lot. But if you have an attraction to that type of lifestyle, it's pretty good. Now, there's a lot of competition between the companies out there. And to some degree, the office is the same way, in that if you're a solid employee and have something to contribute to the company, there's lots of places you can go work in this business today. Parts of the business are in basins in which there's not much activity, but the Permian is just booming. So
it's a good time.
It's a good time to be in the Permian Basin.
About Laredo, we're sitting in your conference room today. Lots of decisions being made around this big table, I'm quite certain.
We just finished a board meeting yesterday.
Somewhere along the line, you said, let's take Laredo public.
Yeah, we had built Laredo up until there was clearly an ongoing profitable company. We were building up some pretty good equity value in the company. But what we realized, I mentioned earlier that the companies before, when we were kind of doing conventional drilling, if we had 3 years of inventory, we were kind of on the really good, excellent side of things. What we've now realized with these horizontal plays, these big shale plays, that you have years of inventory. Everybody has inventory. In 2010, we had a debate amongst ourselves about selling the company. And in some ways, we'd kind of just really gotten started on the horizontal play. A lot of potential. Or do we really want to look at taking the next step in terms of accessing capital and go public? I had never taken a company public. This was before a lot of the rules and regulations really were understood. I mean, we had Sarbanes-Oxley and others. So we listed this company on the New York Stock Exchange December 16th, 2011. My wife was there. Some of my kids were there. I got to ring the bell open December 16th, 2011.
I saw the picture in the lobby.
Yeah.
That was a great moment for you.
Yeah. Now, what I've come to realize is that everybody has bosses. I mean, if I own the company 100%, then I probably have a bank. I probably have obligation to employees. You know, I get lots of input. If you're using private equity, the private equity has a very loud voice at this table with board decisions. And they should, because they put up the money. What you realize as a public company is you have a lot of bosses. Every shareholder has a right to express his opinion. The rules and regulations and the way you communicate with the investor community take a lot of time, a lot of staff, and a lot of my time. And that's changed over the 8 years that we've been public.
Becoming more complicated.
More intense, more complicated every year. So I think going public was the right thing for the company. I think it was good. But then what you realize is that not only are you in a business in which the volatility of your commodity is extreme, you're in a business in which the investors can get in or out of your stock instantly. And if there's a better place for them to put money, like Apple or Facebook or Netflix or some .com or some bank, they're going to do what's best for them and take money out of you and put it there. So now we have a relatively volatile public investor base who can get in and out of the stock pretty quickly. It's another volatility in our company.
How does that affect the company on a daily basis? They're coming in or they're going out?
It actually doesn't affect the company at the operational level, hardly at all. And as you know, nowadays, there's not a lot of retail stock owners. It's mostly big funds and electronically traded platforms of some kind. So I think the volatility really has no short-term impact on our operations. In fact, the company can perform very, very well and still have a declining stock price.
Why?
If the investors decide that they should put that money elsewhere, buy Apple, for example, mm-hmm. which is a good company and had mm-hmm. tremendous growth, they'll sell your stock and buy Apple.
Sure.
What it's done is it's increased the volatility of the public market value of the company. It doesn't really have much impact on our metrics and the operating of the company itself.
So then the capital that came in from going public, that enhanced your...
It did. It greatly helped us fund our drilling activities and our capital program. And that's why you go public, is to have access to funds. We sold equity in the IPO, and we used those funds for acceleration of our drilling program. Prior to that, we had accessed the high-yield debt market some. And as a public company, we were able to refinance that high-yield debt to some degree. So being public has some big advantages in that your equity's traded every day.
What are we trading at today?
I haven't looked today, but a year ago we were somewhere around 10 or 11 bucks. Today we're at 3.5. The entire industry is somewhat out of favor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've seen that before. We've had boom and bust cycles in this industry no matter where you sit, either private or public or MLP or wherever you sit. So we've seen this before.
But your company now is doing well. You say the premium is gangbusters.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you looked at our company as a Permian company only, we have a little less oil content than some of the people that bought acreage further west. So we kind of trade at the bottom end of those dozen or 15 companies. But if you looked at us across North America, we probably are in the top quarter. So it depends a little bit on where you are. The Permian is just so good. I don't think most people realize how this shale revolution has changed our energy position. We're now producing somewhere around 12 million barrels a day in the U.S. We got as low as 5 or so at one point. We are now a power broker on the price of crude worldwide. It's really boiled down to Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the U.S., and the Permian is the dominant part of that U.S. position. So what we've seen is we're no longer having to import an increasing amount of oil every year. We're actually exporting significantly more oil each year. On the natural gas side, with our LNG exports, we're actually exporting LNG to countries whose only source of energy before was Russia or something. So the United States really has a seat at the table now on worldwide energy prices.
Going public, obviously very complicated and all. Are you back and forth with Wall Street? I've never experienced this at all. I'm asking simple questions like many probably are listening to this. What is your interaction with Wall Street because you went public?
The interaction is more with investors. Now, Wall Street is actually a very short street in New York.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of investors based in New York. Part of my job is to make sure that I've communicated to investors what our story really is. Here's what we are. Here's what we're going to be. So we meet with Wall Street in San Francisco. We meet with them in Dallas. We meet with them in Chicago, a lot of New York. There are investor relations conferences, probably 10 a year. I don't make all of them, but if you're public, you really want to make sure that you are communicating with the people that own your shares and the people that you want to own your shares. So probably a third of my time has been spent on the road somewhere talking to current investors and hopefully future investors. And that's a pretty dramatic change from a private company. There's additional governance and SEC filings, so you have to have more people. But the communication of what your company's all about is different. And to be honest, I think I'm still learning how to do that.
How to communicate?
How to communicate our story most effectively. There are people who have been public 30 years through 3 or 4 CEOs who have a long history of how to do that. We've been public since 2011. Part of that time was a boom time. Part of that time is now not. It's a bust time, boom bust cycle. So as a company and personally, we're learning how you really need to communicate. And yeah, it's different than talking to a private company board of directors.
But when you're communicating, when you sit down face to face with these people, you get some tough questions, I would imagine.
I think they have the right to ask you tough questions.
Right.
They've invested their money in your shares, or they're thinking about investing money in your shares. So, yeah, I think they do ask tough questions. And I think they have the right to do that, and I have the obligation to try and answer them.
Right. So you don't take an affront on that. Some can get prickly, I would imagine, their personalities.
Yeah. People are people. and some of them have different approaches to how they ask tough questions. You know, I do understand that I'm a public company, and I do understand that I have to be in the public with shareholders. Whether I like the way they ask the questions or not is really not germane. Regardless of how 1 or 2% approach it, my job is to make sure I communicate the best I can.
Do you enjoy doing that?
For me, I can't say I've always enjoyed that, partially because of the traveling and being gone from home. I do enjoy telling the story. It's a much more difficult story to tell today than it was even 6 months ago. But I do enjoy telling the story. We have a group of good people here who help me do that. So I don't make every one of those meetings nowadays, have some other people that make some. I don't want to make it sound like I look forward to it every time, because I do want to be home and I do want to be here running the company. It's not distasteful. Probably on balance, I enjoy it, but I don't like being gone from home.
Right. But you said it earlier, you like telling the story. You're proud of the story that you have to tell.
Even during the bad times.
Yeah.
I still think the company has a good bunch of employees. We enjoy a really good acreage base. There may be some better, but ours is good. We have a really good balance sheet. We're not over-levered. We have a lot of optionality and things. So I enjoy telling the story.
Mm-hmm. How do you grade your own paper?
Well, I actually think that one of the things that has helped my companies is that I do grade my own paper. And I also have a board of directors that are very involved in the company, and they grade my paper. So I think one of the things that I need to do is to recognize what we've done well, but also recognize what we haven't done well, and try not to make that same mistake again. So I'm pretty focused on saying, okay, what really worked and what didn't work, and what can we learn from both of those? The board's job, I think, is to represent shareholders and to help evaluate management and the CEO. So I grade my paper a lot. I don't ever want to get to where I take it for granted that we're going to be successful. I don't want to ever take it for granted that we're not going to make mistakes. But I want to make sure that I maximize what I've learned from prior mistakes and try and minimize mistakes going forward.